Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers. FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. F up the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin tail pro. Show, they got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we rise up, unity is so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, if you think this shit's gonna be televised. Black power, be scared guys, that be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fuck me promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin tail pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, cause that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black women and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack upped up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prisons. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
The two great crimes in American history is obviously the destruction of this country's Native American, the near destruction, I should say, not the destruction, the near destruction of this country's Native American population, the theft of their land. And on to work that land was brought in Native Africans into this country beginning in 1619. Those twin processes profoundly altered the shape of the world and made this country possible. Obviously, first of all, you know, the land on which, you know, America and Americans currently reside was the land of Native Americans. But the people brought in to break that land just transformed it. The profits derived from slavery are more extreme than I think are commonly acknowledged. As I said yesterday, in 1860, the combined worth of the 4 million enslaved black people in this country was some $3 billion, nearly $75 billion in today's share of dollars. Cotton, in 1860 was this country's largest export, not just its largest export, it was the majority of exports out of this country. So from a financial perspective, just the economics of it, it's absolutely impossible to imagine America without enslavement. The onset of the Civil War, the greatest preponderance, the greatest population per capita of millionaires and multimillionaires in this country was in the Mississippi River Valley. It wasn't in Boston, wasn't in Chicago, wasn't in New York. The richest people in this country were slaveholders. Most of our earliest presidents were slaveholders. And the fact that they were presidents is not incidental to the fact that they're their slaveholding. That was how they built their wealth. That was how Thomas Jefferson built his wealth. That was how George Washington built his wealth. Individual slaves were the equivalent of, say, owning a home today. They were people, but turned into objects of extreme wealth. So just from the economic perspective, there's that. And just forgive me for extending a little bit, but there's also the fact of what America actually is culturally. Our greatest export today is our entertainment and it is our culture. It is impossible to imagine American culture without jazz, without the blues, without hip-hop. It's impossible to imagine American cinema without, regrettably, Birth of a Nation. It's impossible to imagine American literature at this point without James Baldwin, without Toni Morrison. All of these are the primary, secondary, and tertiary fruits of slavery. And so if you strip slavery out of America, if you strip black people out of America, you really don't have in America. When I started in 2014, I actually was, at that point, for reparations, but you're referring back to something I wrote in 2012 when I was, against. I wouldn't have been able to give you that answer. I didn't have that level of knowledge. And beyond that, I didn't have the level of knowledge on how it persisted. I mean, I had a vague sense of segregation, Jim Crow, et cetera, in the 100 years after. But I didn't know about redlining, not in that degree of detail. And I didn't know how this extraction, as I call it, of wealth from the African-American community laundered through the state into the white community, through redlining, through the FHA loan program, through the GI Bill. I just didn't have knowledge of that. And once I saw that, it's like, wow, this is a persistent, a pattern of extraction that needs a really, really radical answer. At that point, reparations made total sense to me. But I will add that it made sense to plenty of people long before it made sense to me. I think in this moment, one of the reasons why, this sort of, all of these questions that may have been, off of the table in 2016 or off the table in 2008, it's not that people weren't raising them. It's not that, people weren't making the point. But I just think, in reaction to what's going on in this country right now, people are just much, much more open. And in terms of poverty and race in this country, again, one of the things that I really, really wanted to stress is it's the level of poverty specifically that you see in the African-American community. It's not accidental. It's not accidental. This was this is part of the process. The process of enslavement involves stealing something from someone. It involves taking something from someone. Jim Crow was theft. First and foremost, it was theft. If I tax you, or if I tell you you have to be loyal to this country and pledge fealty to its laws, but then I don't give you the same degree of protection, I don't give you the same access to resources that I give to another group of people, I have effectively stolen something from you. I've stolen your tax money. I've stolen your fealty. I've stolen your loyalty. So when the state of Mississippi, for instance, taxes black people and then builds one facility for education and another for education for whites and then an inferior facility for blacks. That's theft. That's theft. If I build a public pool system and then tell you you can't use that public pool system, that's theft. And so that is the long history of this country that doesn't end, again, conservatively until, in 1968. And so there are people who are very, very much alive who have experienced that, who are suffering the after effects and effects of that. And that's what, as far as I'm concerned, the whole movement around reparations is about. Reparations isn't just about enslavement. There was the 250 years of enslavement, that period of theft. After that, there was 100 years of terror, that period of theft. And, I would argue, in fact, our present system of mass incarceration emerges right out of that. And so, this notion that a nation somehow only especially when we're talking about its debits, that it only lasts through the lifetime of its present generation is clearly ridiculous. The state itself would fall apart if that were true. If all of our treaties were broken when this generation died, if all of our taxes and responsibilities, if we said to pensioners, you know, we will no longer pay you because the people that, you know, made the decisions about those wars are no longer alive, we would have a huge problem. As I said yesterday, to this very day, or at least I should say as recently as 2017, we were paying pensions to the heirs of Civil War widows. When you have that lengthy of a history of what can only be called robbery, often state-sanctioned and at best with the state looking the other way, it seems pretty logical that one aspect, and I would argue an essential aspect, of fixing that situation is paying people back.
Those of us who've been following your work for a long time think of you first and foremost as a blogger, although you were a reporter before you were a blogger, but I remember reading and loving your blog for many years. But now you've added a new title to your resume, and that is novelist. Tell us about the origin of this book. You've been working on it for a long time. Where did the idea come from?
Oh, man, we only got 20 minutes. Wow. How do I answer that without taking up half the time?
You could take as much time as you want. This is your stage.
There's a ticking clock right there.
Let me worry about that.
Google will get the hook. I would say that question has a lot of answers, but I think the one that probably is most interesting, because it's a lot of things that came together, is the realization on the limitations of facts. During my earlier period as a blogger for The Atlantic, I spent a good bit of time blogging about the Civil War, which was at that time and still remains one of the most misunderstood, important events in American history. And you could quote the causes of the Civil War from people who were stating their terms of aggression at the time. You could assemble all the data you wanted, all the historical evidence you wanted that made it clear that the war was about the continuation and the expansion of slavery, and people would look at you and just would say, no, it's not. And it became really, really clear that you weren't really having a conversation about facts. You were having a conversation about deeply, deeply embedded beliefs and myths. And so it wasn't so much that you would even be able to persuade a certain sector with evidence, with the kind of things that we assemble in nonfiction. It became pretty clear to me that you needed to tell new stories. There was a story around Robert E. Lee, for instance. There was a story around Nathan Bedford Forrest, the founder of the Ku Klux Klan and thus the inaugurator of the largest domestic terrorism campaign in American history. And yet and still in the state of Tennessee, there are more statues of Nathan Bedford Forrest than any other public figure. That's because certain stories and mythologies had been erected around these people. And so I just became concerned, how could it be that the cause of enslavement, the cause of selling off people's children, the cause of destroying families, how did that become mythologized, you know, and softened down into the General Lee and the Dukes of Hazzard? And it became clear to me that we needed new stories. And so The Water Dancer, my new novel, is an attempt to tell a different one.
So this story does, in some ways, kind of create a new mythology of its own. Your main character, Hiram Walker, he's the son of a plantation owner and an enslaved mother. And as a young man, he discovers that he has these unusual powers. And I think one of the big themes that's run through your work, certainly your nonfiction work, is the importance of memory. And I would say the power of amnesia. I mean, amnesia, I think, is kind of the American superpower, this ability to persuade ourselves of our innocence by not remembering. So it struck me that that you created a character whose superpower is memory. Could you just talk about that character and the importance of memory?
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly correct. I mean, it's allegorical, you know. And one of the dynamics in the book is between the slaveholders and the enslaved. We give them different names in the book, because if you need different stories, you need different names. And so in the book, the enslavers are called the quality, and the enslaved are called the task. And one of the things that the main character comes to quickly realize as he matures throughout it is essential to the power of enslaving people, essential to the ability to commit the very, very brutal, dehumanizing acts that one must commit in order to enslave somebody is the power of forgetting. You have to forget. We should pause a moment and talk about how intimate plantation slavery was. It was not uncommon for a young black child to grow up right next to a young white child and for them to play together until they reached a relative age where they were charged with assuming their particular roles. And in order to for that young white child to do what he or she had to do to that young black child, in order to do what the system mandates, you have to be good at compartmentalizing certain things. Because to dehumanize, you can't remember playing with somebody. You can't remember the little games that y'all played together, little dances y'all played together. You can't remember that person sticking up. You have to somehow confine them to over here. And so, one of the things that Hiram talks about in the book, and I think this is actually true of our country, is that when we want to do horrible things, the first thing we have to do is we have to forget.
Mm. So what does Hiram remember? Walk us through the story.
Hiram remembers everything. That's part of the problem. Hiram remembers every little thing. If Hiram were here right now, he could repeat verbatim everything that you and I just said, everything that Killer Mike and Anderson just said. But he could not remember the things that are most intimate to him. And in the story, that is his mother. His mother has been sold off by his father. Hiram is the product of sexual violence. There is no choice under the system of enslavement. It's all coercion. And even though he can remember every single little detail, he only knows his mother because the enslaved community in which he exists has told him about his mother. But were it up to him, he probably would forget his mother, push her into the down there of his mind, as he says.
So I want to linger a little bit on the language, and you talked about this already a little bit, but in the book you call the enslaved the tasked, and the enslavers are called the quality. And I also noticed that you call there's a power that Hiram has called conduction. Talk to me about how you kind of created the language that you used in the book and why it was necessary to bring these words, which are, they're not new words, but they're words being used in a different way than we typically do.
Yeah, I think naming things, and for those who are undergoing the oppression, those who have the boot on their neck to claim the power is very, very important. I'll give an example if I can bring this together. For the past, 20 or so years, it has been pretty much the stipulation that we, refer to those who experienced the crime of rape as rape survivors, no longer as rape victims. And I, like most, people with common sense and decent respect, have used that terminology, though I can't tell you that I understood why I was using that terminology or what it quite meant. And it was only through writing this book that I came to that. That is to say that there is a thing that somebody does to you, that somebody takes your body, they capture your body, and they do the thing to you. And then it's the name that people put on you, which erases everything about you. So being raped is a thing that happened to you. It's not the thing you want to be seen as. It's not the thing that should obviate every little detail about your life. And I found a very similar thing with enslavement. Slave sounds like something that the person is, as opposed to the condition which somebody else put upon them. Black people in this country from the period of 1619 to 1865 were not slaves. They were enslaved. A thing was done to them. And underneath of that was all of their humanity, all of their, identity, all the laughing, all the crying, all the mourning, all the singing, all the dancing. It was not, what was done to them was not their identity. And that became really, really important in the course of writing the book. And I have to tell you, that was a lesson to me. Because sometimes, we're in this era, if I can just go off a little bit, we're in this era right now where sometimes people ask for new labels. And because we don't necessarily understand those labels, we deride them. We don't comprehend why, folks want new names. And so we, make fun of them. We make jokes about them. But maybe it's worth being respectful and just calling people what they ask for. And maybe you'll catch up a little later. Maybe it just takes a second, you know? And for me, this was really essential because the process of writing is always the process of learning, acquiring new things.
I was curious who some of your influences were when you were writing this book. I mean, I see elements of Octavia Butler. I see some, you know, obviously you're a comics writer, so you know, drew from that experience and your love of comics, some Toni Morrison, maybe some Stephen King. What did you draw from? Because, I mean, you know, clearly fiction is something that you've been thinking about for a long time, but it's a shift.
Yeah, although oddly enough, I started this before I started Between the World and Me and before I started almost everything, and We Were 8 Years in Power. So most writing, this is older than almost anything that most people know me for. So if I would say in no particular order, my influences are the great novelist E.L. Doctorow, who was masterful at this task of remembering, of conjuring history and making you feel like you were right there. I read a book like Ragtime, and I felt like I was, you know, right there, Billy Basket. I feel like I'm right there. I'm right in the midst of it. I would say Toni Morrison, simply because I don't know of another novelist who was a better crafter of sentences. And that sounds very minor and very, you know, particular and maybe not very important. But in fact, I think part of the power that people achieve in their writing, when you're trying to achieve that power, the main thing you're trying to do is be as efficient as possible and condense as much emotion, as much feeling, as much intensity into as small a space as you possibly can. And Toni was an absolute master of that. And then finally, you know, Frederick Douglass. Who is known as a great American hero, as he should be, but was just a gorgeous writer. Like, I think people have just forgotten that. I mean, just a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful writer. David Blight, in his new book, basically is writing a biography of a writer.
It's a fantastic book. Yeah.
Yes, no, it's a gorgeous and incredible book. And then, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I got to say this, embodying the spirit that Anderson and Killer Mike just left, hip hop was my first literary influence. Mm-hmm. That will always be the first thing I think about.
I think I heard in an interview in which you said, and I don't know if this was the order, Rakim, Dungeons and Dragons, and
comic books.
It was about
Dungeons and Dragons.
I was like, that'll do you. That'll do you. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I think of you primarily as a journalist, and you've talked a lot about the importance of reporting. And one of the things that's really striking about this novel is how deeply reported it is. Mm. I mean, like the physical landscape of the plantation, but then also the way that you managed to capture the interior life of the enslaved, which there's one set of documentation that's very, mm-hmm. you know, fragmented and partial to draw on, mm-hmm. but also how you've managed to capture in a very human way the enslaver, I mean the master. So talk a little bit about your process of doing research for this book and how you how it came together.
Yeah, so the first thing I'll just say really quickly on that note of capturing the enslaver is if they're too evil, you don't believe them. You understand what I'm saying? And if they're too evil, it actually kind of loses its power because you have the ease of being able to say, oh, it's no way that couldn't have been me. So in every one of these characters, there's some of me. You know, I had to imagine myself even into the people that are doing the worst possible things. I had to find myself, you know, in it, because that's the only way the reader finds, you know, themselves in it. In terms of the research, I mean, I spent a good, I don't know, I mean, most of the last 10 years, you know, visiting, you know, enslaved plantations around this country. I went to the Whitney Plantation down in New Orleans, Shirley Plantation in Virginia, various Civil War sites, Montpelier in Virginia, James Madison's, you know, home, Thomas Jefferson's, Monticello, which had a huge, huge influence, you know, on me and really, you know, helped me work through a lot of feelings about Thomas Jefferson. And much of this book is probably influenced by that, being by the physical architecture of Monticello and by many of the...
Well, like Monticello, Lockless is a failed plantation.
It's a failed, it is.
People often don't know what a lousy businessman Thomas Jefferson was.
Yes, he was a horrible businessman. Thomas Jefferson, what I always tell people is Thomas Jefferson died in debt. You got to be a really bad businessman to have no labor costs and die in debt. And
pro tip.
And less funny. When Thomas Jefferson died, they looked around to figure out how they were going to pay the debt, and they looked at the land, and they looked at the furniture, and they looked at all the nice things that they had accumulated, and they realized that virtually all of the value of the plantation was in the people that they had enslaved.
Hmm.
And so to satisfy those debts, they sold off those people right on the lawn of Monticello and divided those families. And that knowledge, that reality, you know what I mean, very much fueled me through this book. I always tell everybody should go to Monticello, but African Americans specifically should really, really go to Monticello.
You mentioned families being separated. I mean, we can't help but think about what's happening in our country right now with family separation. As you said, this book's been with you a long time, but the idea of separating children from their parents is not a new American idea. This is something very old.
No, it's not. And what I strongly suspect is whenever you seek to oppress or exploit another group of people, you attack their families. I think that's always a line of contention. You know, I think, in the most recent fight over marriage equality, it's about the right to form and protect families. That was a huge, huge line. And so I don't even know that it was new for us so much as family is so elemental, you know, to any group of human beings. That, you know, when you find yourself in a conflict and somebody's trying to exploit you, that's the first thing that, you know, folks go for. I will say that it was very, very important for me to write this book in a certain way and to show the intensity of the love and the caring that was in black families because we exist in a time where we are often told that the black family is pathological, that they're problems with the black family, it's bad culture in the black family, and men don't care about the kids, you know, women talk all kinds of ways today, all this, you know, all sorts of, you know, negative ideas about how we relate to each other in family. And whenever I do historical research, not just at this period, but whenever I've done, you know, historical research here in America, what I found is quite the opposite. And in fact, people trying to form families among the most harshest and, you know, unimaginable and violent conditions. And so it was very, very important for me when I was writing this book to focus on those efforts to maintain, strengthen, you know, and endure among black families during that period.
John Conyers just passed away. Mm-hmm. You know, rest in power. You wrote the your piece, The Case for Reparations. I think you found yourself in the somewhat uncomfortable position of testifying before Congress about reparations. Are you, I mean, how has it been from your vantage point to see the subject of reparations come to the foreground, be embraced by, you know, credible contenders for the Democratic nomination, talked about in a different way in society?
I'm very pleased. I am one who believes that the dominant relationship between what we call black people in this country and what we call white people in this country is one of robbery and theft. That extends, you know, from the 250 years of enslavement in this country through the 100 years of Jim Crow, in which black people were robbed of the right to vote, robbed of the right to participate in the political process, in which they were taxed and an entire public architecture was erected throughout the southern states, public pools, public universities, public schools, public libraries that they were excluded from despite paying into it. Through the period, you know, through the same period, post-war period, in more northern cities, when black people were attempting to exercise their rights to move into nicer communities and were met with firebombs and, you know, legislation from local officials that sought to, you know, confine them to ghettos. When you have that lengthy of a history of what can only be called robbery, often state-sanctioned and at best with the state looking the other way, it seems pretty logical that one aspect, and I would argue an essential aspect of fixing that situation is paying people back, admitting what you did and paying people back. And so I'm one who's always viewed reparations, or not always, but certainly since I wrote the article, viewed, you know, reparations not as part of a solution, not as one solution, but as the essential solution. I don't know how you fix a situation where you have a 20-to-1 wealth gap in this country without some sort of transfer. Because the transfer is exactly what happened to us, a negative transfer.
A transfer of our labor, our value.
Our bodies.
Our bodies. Everything. Other people. So I hate to ask you what's next, because you're just at the end of a really difficult book tour. I'm sure it's been exciting.
I'm not
also
at the
exhausting.
End.
Oh, really? It's going on after this?
Wow. I got another 2 out of 3 weeks.
Another 2 out of 3 weeks.
Yeah, you can ask me when my after this. I mean, I'm happy. You know, I'm very, very pleased. You know, Oprah picked the book up. I was very, very shocked and surprised and just, you know, elated by that. Right. I'm happy that there's an audience. I'm happy that you guys are here listening to my haranguing on the country and things that we'd rather not talk about. And so I have another 2 weeks of that, you know, and then I'm going to take my family on vacation for Thanksgiving, and I'm going to chill out for a little while. That's what's next for me. And I'm going to enjoy my holiday.
All right. Well, you deserve it. Ta-Nehisi Coates, thank you very much.
Good evening. I'm Steve Edwards, the Executive Director of the University of Chicago's Institute of Politics, and I wish this event had garnered more interest. It's fantastic to see such a packed audience for what we know will be a terrific conversation tonight. And before we get into a formal introduction for tonight's event featuring Ta-Nehisi Coates and the Cates for Reparations, I want to make a special thanks to all of our partners here who helped make tonight's event possible. The International House, which is hosting us tonight, this is part of their Global Voices series. Our friends at the Center for the Study of Race, Politics, and Culture, the Office of Multicultural Student Affairs, and the National Public Housing Museum. Please join me in giving them a warm round of applause for all of this. Thanks. Now, you know, I think many journalists, many writers will spend their entire career hoping to have the kind of impact cumulatively that Ta-Nehisi has had in just his time as a writer, but particularly in one article in the June issue of The Atlantic. The Case for Reparations, 15,000 words, set deeply here in Chicago, spanning hundreds of years of history, took a topic that for so many of us had been marginalized, historicized, and largely absent from the public conversation and put it front and center. To put some perspective on the kind of energy and conversation that this triggered, not only in evidence here tonight by all of you here, more online visitors read that article in a single day than any previous Atlantic magazine story. We're talking about a publication with 150-plus year history. The June issue sold 60% more copies on the newsstand than its counterpart the same year ago. And in more than 200 events that we've been able to host here in our short 2 years on campus at the Institute of Politics, this has been without question one of the most anticipated conversations tonight. This is part of our series of events where we hope to elevate and expand the public conversation. We'll be taking a brief hiatus, as all of you do, for Thanksgiving, and then back at it the first week of December. We will have a conversation that will focus on national security, featuring the Washington Post's David Ignatius, also former Congresswoman Jane Harman, and former U.S. Ambassador to NATO Ivo Dalder. That will take place on Thursday the 4th. You can find out more about that event and all of our other events at politics.uchicago.edu. Tonight's event is being live-streamed and recorded for podcast. You can check out all of our podcasts on iTunes by subscribing to UChicago IOP. And you can also follow us on Twitter at UChiPolitics. Finally, during our conversation tonight, we will, as is customary at the Institute of Politics, open the floor to your questions. And we ask, though, that when you do, we're going to expand, actually, the time for questions tonight, just given the size of this audience and I know the interest that many of you will have in joining the conversation. But to accommodate as many of you as possible, we ask that you keep the questions short and to the point. We ask that they actually be a question. And the moderator has reserved the right to sort of cut you off if that's not the case. And in keeping with the university's values, we also ask that you uphold those standards of inquiry and civility and open discourse. I'm here to formally introduce our speakers on our program tonight is Anastasia Kaiser. She's a fourth year at the university majoring in economics and public policy. She's a member of our student executive board. And tonight's event may not have happened if it weren't for her. We have a proposal process where students actually can suggest speakers and programs that the Institute will bring to campus. And she brought the Ta-Nehisi Coates suggestion through our proposal process. I'm proud to say, even before the Case for Reparations cover story. Please join me in welcoming Anastasia Kaiser to the podium.
Tonight, we are incredibly fortunate to be joined by James Bennett, the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, and by Ta-Nehisi Coates, a senior editor and writer for The Atlantic, to talk about Ta-Nehisi's powerful piece, The Case for Reparations, which most of you are holding and which all of you should read. The article, which was published in the June 2014 issue of The Atlantic and is set mostly in Chicago, was the product of 2 years of reporting and was released to overwhelming reader response and to overwhelming critical praise. The Case for Reparations argues that long after slavery ended in America, decades of racist policies and deliberate injustices, from redlining to Jim Crow, have systematically wronged generations of African Americans, and that, quote, until we reckon with our compounding moral debts, America will never be whole. Ta-Nehisi Coates is currently the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Visiting Scholar at MIT, where he teaches a class on writing and journalism. In 2008, he published The Beautiful Struggle, a memoir about growing up in West Baltimore. And when I told people that I would be introducing Ta-Nehisi tonight, three of them said to me separately, he's one of the people in America I admire the most, and he's maybe one of the most admired journalists of our time. James Bennett is the 14th editor-in-chief of The Atlantic. Prior to joining the magazine in 2006, he was the Jerusalem bureau chief for The New York Times. Both of these figures are incredibly inspiring to me as an aspiring journalist. So I hope you join me in giving a very warm welcome to our two distinguished guests this evening, James Bennett and Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Thank you very much, Steve and Anastasia. And I'd like to say thank you to the Institute of Politics for having us out, and International House for hosting us tonight. And thank you to all of you for being here. Ta-Nehisi struck a very, very deep chord with this piece, and it's a wonderful compliment and testament to the power of his work that you're all here. We're going to talk for maybe a half hour at the start and then open it up to questions from you guys. We'd like to get to as many as we can about this story or about other subjects Ta-Nehisi's been writing about that might be on your minds, from Bill Cosby to Ferguson to what it's like to learn French at his advancing age. But first we're going to show a video that The Atlantic did to accompany this piece. And so, Ta-Nehisi, maybe you should set up the video, talk a little bit about what people are going to see.
Well, you know, one of the cool things about working on the Case for Reparations is shortly after I, you know, presented the idea to my editors, including James, there was this immediate feeling that this was the sort of piece that we could approach in a multimedia sort of way. So if you look at how the Case for Reparations looks online, The Atlantic puts tremendous amount of resources into, you know, all of its stories. Anytime you see, you know, like a big feature like that, what's behind that is, you know, a lot of hard work in terms of editing, a lot of hard work in terms of fact checking, a lot of hard work in terms of copy editing, a lot of hard work in terms of reporting and writing resources. But I think, you know, there was some feeling among folks at The Atlantic that, you know, more resources could be put in another direction, and that was to create a multimedia feel for the story. So if you read it online, you can see we have maps of Chicago, for instance, that reflect the redlining. That's, you know, a big part of it. You can see that we have, you know, primary text that you can look at when we're talking about the period of enslavement in this country. You can even see the original piece that we did, that we didn't even know we had done until we started researching this, but that we had done on North Lawndale and contract buying. And
In 1972,
and so it was, you know, quite a joy to be able to come back, you know, to North Lawndale and write about the neighborhood and, you know, revisit the issue. And one of the ways we did it is in this film, which profiles the Contract Buyers League,
And this is, you know, tremendously important to me because what it shows is that, you know, you can talk about, you know, the boot on the neck, you know, of African Americans in a city like Chicago or nationally. But the other side of that is people who are struggling against. There's always a struggle, you know, against it. So this video is very much about that struggle.
The question of housing is one of the major problems this country faces. By and large, blacks live in substandard housing. Those who manage to fight their way out of it frequently pay a large penalty to do so.
I came from Birmingham, Alabama, but I came to Chicago for a better living and a job. I bought here this house in 58. It ain't nothing to brag about, but it's mine.
My name's Clyde Ross. I was born in Clarksville, Mississippi. I bought this house in 1958.
I moved in this house in 1957. It was mostly a white area. And when they said that the niggers was coming, they didn't say black, they said the niggers was coming. And they just start moving away. Mostly everyone that was black, they had been sold a contract. If you missed the payment in 3 months, they could take the property back. No lawyer, no nothing could help you. That was it.
There are blocks like this scattered throughout the Lawndale section of Chicago's West Side ghetto. The people who live here bought their homes from real estate speculators at double or triple their value, and they bought on contract because they couldn't get conventional or FHA mortgages. Under the contract, the buyer makes installment payments at high interest, but he builds no equity. If he defaults on even one payment at any time during the contract, he loses the property and everything he's paid into it.
We'll pay $26,000, and the house is worth $12,000. That means I was overcharged quite a bit, and the contract situation was so bad until Well, if something broke down, you had to fix it. You had to pay your water and gas and electric and the taxes and everything else, but you didn't have the ownership.
How could we be charged like that if that wasn't a law? And how would the law let them do this? But they said it was their property. They had a choice to sell it at whatever price they wanted to. And if you bought it, then that was on you.
With three girls. I worked at council, post office, and I delivered pieces for 4 to 5 years. I get home at 10 o'clock every night, you know. Leave home at 6 o'clock every morning. Kids be asleep. They don't see me. And when they did see me on the weekend, I tell them something, they look at their mama and say, well, should I do it or should I not? Who is this guy, you know? I was staying in my own home because of that contract thing. Really a stranger. I thought, this is not going to work.
These people who have cheated us out of more than money, we have been cheated out of the right to be human beings in a society. We have been cheated out of buying homes at a decent price. Now it's time now. We got a chance now. The Contract Buyers League have presented a chance for these people in this area to move out of this grip of society, to move up, stand on your own 2 feet, be human beings, fight for what you know is right. Fight! Thank you.
I really believe that, you know, ultimately what we're after is some kind of communication among human beings, but that can only be affected when people can approach each other on the basis of equality.
Yeah, but even though you are keeping within the law, this is really war, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
The college students and I went up and down the streets and asked people if they bought on contract. And we discovered that the average overcharge was $10,000, and then computed the monthly payments so that we knew that black folks were paying a race tax of about $20,000 per family.
You would just go to their house and ask them, is you on a contract? Someone said, I don't know. Some of them didn't want to talk to you. And they would say, no, I'm on a mortgage. But when they bring the paper, I know it wasn't no mortgage, because that's what I had, a piece of paper. Everybody practically was on contract.
People on the west side and the south side were being blamed for things that were not of their own making. This is the best example I can think of institutional racism. White folks created the ghetto. And it drives me crazy today even that we don't admit that.
The people of Lawndale organized the Contract Buyers Week, and during the past year, the league began urging large numbers of buyers to withhold the payments on their contracts. By withholding the payments, the league has managed to renegotiate, enabling the buyer to build equity and saving him an average of $10,000.
There were 550 families in the payment strike. People knew how to handle pickets. People knew how to handle, you tell them, their neighbors. But when you're hitting them in the pocketbook with a payment strike, that was serious business.
They said, well, you got to pay this money at 260 every month. Nah, we ain't paying you nothing until you get this contract right.
They came up, rang the bell, still in bed, and the wife went to the door. They served her with a paper, and then they came on in.
What did they say to you?
They said they were going to evict us.
And where's your furniture now?
Out on the street.
What do you plan to do? Do you believe that you should forward it and pay it like you were doing before?
No, I won't. I won't give them the money.
We just wanted to get a fair price for the house, you know, and we wanted the mortgage where we could have ownership of the house. And the contract violation brought us to a point where we could understand that we could do something about this.
The people of the CBL have come together. No matter what happens, we are fighting for one thing. That is justice. And believe me, as long as we stick together and keep growing in large numbers like we've done now, something got to happen.
I've always wanted to own my own house because I worked for white people when I was in the South, and they had beautiful homes, and I always said one day I was going to have me one, and I finally did.
The house was paid for. No more fright of losing it. It felt good. It really felt good.
Two of the heroes of that story are actually with us tonight, Clyde Ross and Jack McNamara. Would you mind standing, please? How do you interpret that video in the end? Is that a story of triumph or
it's
despair?
It's funny you ask that. Because even as I was watching it, it bothers me a little bit. I mean, no disrespect to Kashi, who's our genius, you know, video editor. I'm happy, you know, for the great work, you know, Jack did, for Mr. Ross, for his, you know, ridiculous, incredible, almost superhuman determination. I have, you know, no problem saying that were I in that situation, I would have lost my home. And I don't think that's, you know, a particularly shameful thing. The people that you saw, and I was aware of this, and, you know, I think, you know, Mr. Ross and everybody went through this, were aware of the stories that you hear about heroism. These are the exceptional people. The vast majority of black people, though, and, you know, this can never be forgotten, the vast majority of black people are ordinary. Just like the vast majority of humanity is ordinary. Most people are not going to be able to work, you know, three different jobs at the same time, you know, in order to hold on to their homes. It's just not, you know, within the normal human, you know, range of capacity. And so most people in that situation, in that system, did lose their homes. You know, we had that note at the end, but they did lose their home, and other people, you know, were enriched because of that. And so I think this video is very, very important because I think, you know, obviously Mr. Ross, I think Ms. Weatherspoon, I think Ms. Lewis, and I think Jack, I think all of the work that they put in, all the work of the Contract Buyers League, you know, it deserves, you know, recognition and deserves that great, you know, standing applause that folks just gave. But at the same time, I don't want people to watch that video and walking away with this kind of smug happiness that, for instance, we often have about the civil rights movement. You know, this need to give ourselves, you know, prizes and awards because somebody through a struggle that they should not have had to, you know, wage in the first place. Never forget that. Never forget that it was unjust that, you know, Mr. Ross had to work three jobs in the first place. You know, managed to do it. It's I think about this. Is a quick digression. I think about this. I was watching a documentary on the Freedom Riders a while back. And actually 2 weeks ago, not a while back. Not that long ago. Because, you know, what that is going to flatter what I'm about. It's going to flatter me a little bit too much. I thought about the Freedom Riders, and my understanding with the Freedom Riders is that they had gone south, and they were trying to, you know, integrate interstate, you know, bus lines and integrate, you know, the waiting areas and everything, that they were actually trying to affect a change of law. What I did not realize was that, in fact, segregation by letter of the law was illegal at that point. The Supreme Court had already ruled on it. And what the Freedom Riders were actually trying to do was to get the federal government to enforce the law as it was, you know, and that, I mean, and to see that, and then, you know, to see Bobby Kennedy and the way that, you know, he assaulted them in the press, to see, you know, how, you know, for President Kennedy, how, you know, they were just basically, you know, a pain, you know, in the rear end, and you think about that, and yet everybody wants to be proud about the Freedom Riders today, you know, but how did we as a state regard them in that time? You know, so I think, like, it's very, very important that, you know, we as a country, we as a state not, you know, use these moments like this, you know, like all these great anniversaries that we're having right now to give ourselves, you know, too many accolades and to feel too good about it. You know, the fact that Mr. Ross, the fact that, you know, I think the estimate was 85% of African Americans who bought homes during that period were in a contract loan situation was fundamentally unjust. That can never, you know, be made good by the fact that, you know, some folks through their own, you know, ingenuity, through their own dignity, through their own hard work, fought back. The fight itself, that it was brought to them, the war itself, as, you know, Jack talked about in the film, that was watching them, was fundamentally unjust, and I think, you know, that should always be remembered.
So let's back up a step or so, and why don't you tell the story? How was it that you found yourself in Mr. Ross's living room? Why did you choose to focus on North Lawndale and more broadly Chicago,
right,
when you were thinking about making the big argument,
right,
that you were making?
Well, Chicago, as I'm sure, you know, most of the people in this room know, is, you know, one of the most studied cities, you know, in America. You know, sociology basically got its start right here at the University of Chicago. So, you know, beginning, you know, from, you know, a place of knowing that you're going to have to make a very, very difficult argument for reparations, right? Like, most people are not really going to want to hear that. You really need to have as much data as you possibly can. And for Chicago, I mean, it's just a wealth of sociological data. you know, and history, frankly, on Chicago. And the great thing about that, though, is that a lot of that reflects nationally. So you can, you know, there are many books, many studies that can tell you about, you know, what redlining was and what its effect was specifically in Chicago. But we know that redlining was a national system. We're very aware of that. So you can, you know, come to a city like Chicago and, you know, render this really, really, you know, deep and detailed story because so many academics, quite frankly, have done so much research before you. And then you can, you know, by that measure, you know, tell a story about the nation as a whole. So the first, you know, that's a long way of saying laziness. That's the first thing. You know, I mean, and this is like, I mean, we're working on something else right now, which I won't talk about. But one of the things is, you know, it's like, oh, we can't go back to Chicago. We can't do that. And one of the things that, you know, I haven't said this to you, but one of the things that I'm already facing is that there's just not the same wealth of sociological data that you have in Chicago to make a case. So that was the first thing. The second thing was, you know, in North Lawndale, I read Burl Satter's, you know, tremendous, tremendous book, you know, the history of contract, lending system in North Lawndale specifically. It's a beautiful, beautiful historical work. And even though, you know, Burl doesn't make an argument for reparations in the book, he's very clearly, you know, leading that way. I mean, it's like an unfinished sentence, you know. You can say that in a lot of the work about, you know, Chicago, Arnold Hirsch's, you know, work, Making the Second Ghetto, you can see the unfinished sentence that somebody actually did something and that there should be some sort of accounting for it. And so she rendered, you know, frankly, North Lawndale so, you know, deep and detailed in that book. And after reading about the system, you know, I believe Burl published a book in like 2004 maybe or something like that. So, you know, I was coming almost 10 years later, and I wondered how many of those people, you know, who might have either been interviewed in her book or who were, you know, around, I mean, who were, you know, who had been a part of the Contract Buyers League, who had bought homes in that way, might actually still be alive. Because I thought it was very, very important to not allow people to easy out of saying, well, you're talking about reparations, you're talking about something that happened 150 years ago. No, we are talking about a system of plunder that begins in 1619 and continues up, you know, arguably, if you want to be conservative, until, you know, the 1960s. And that people who went through that are alive, and their children are alive, and we can depict and show, you know, how that works. And so Bro was very kind, connected me with Jack, who was, you know, just exceedingly, exceedingly kind with his time, who then connected me with several folks who had been involved in the Contract Buyers League. Mr. Ross was actually, lucky enough, was the first person I talked to. And I don't know if I've ever told him, but he was really, really a guiding force in the sense that when I walked in and I asked him, I said, Mr. Ross, you know, where's your family originally from? And he said, Clarksville, Mississippi. And I said, well, why did you come to Chicago? And he said to me, well, I was seeking the protection of the law. And I didn't quite understand what he was saying. I asked him again, I said, you know, can you explain that? And he said, well, there were no black lawyers in Clarksville. There were no black police officers in Clarksville. There were no black prosecutors in Clarksville. If you were black in Clarksville, that meant that there was no law. That meant that people could just come and take things from you. There was nobody there to protect you. There was nothing to appeal to. And that, like, really, you know, shifted the frame for me. Because traditionally when people talk about the Jim Crow era, you know, as I said, there are all these symbols of civil rights that, you know, people like to, you know, trot out that make us, you know, feel, you know, really, really good about the fact that, you know, we don't have, you know, certain signs up anymore. I mean, that's sort of how we see the South. But what Mr. Ross was talking about was, no, this was engineered anarchy. This was, you know, ruled by, you know, pirates, a bandit class coming in, you know, and taking things from us, and us, you know, being branded effectively outside of society, outside of the protections of society. And so I just, you know, thought, you know, if you could, you know, sort of show that string, you know, all the way from Clarksville, you know, all the way up to North Lawndale, where you see, you know, a group of people cut out of the usual channels of home buying and then left to the predation of pirates to do whatever they want to those people, to take from those people, to plunder from those people. I thought it was, you know, just really, really important to show.
One of the amazing things you do in this piece, and I think in all your work, is you have this ability to reach into history and extract news from it, you know? I mean, it's our story of ourselves, but we actually don't walk around thinking about it or talking about it. I should have said, actually, it's also true that you come to Chicago just because you like Chicago.
I do come to Chicago because there is that, right?
And so one of the things you do in this piece is show that the reparations conversation has traditionally been dominated in this country by talk about what's owed because of slavery. What you show is actually, no, it's about the denial of the ability to accumulate wealth across generations. Mm-hmm. But you also show that there's a very old tradition of talking about and even paying reparations in the U.S. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, and this is like one of those things where you just have, you know, a hunch as a historian. And there's a very beautiful simplicity to a reparations argument that, you know, has reverberation, you know, across history. Laws are passed to keep people from taking things unjustly from other people. And it, when in the case that, you know, things are taken, we often penalize people, you know, for, you know, repayment. That's just a basic thing that, you know, is as old as human society. And if that's the case, then it can't be as is often presented that, you know, this argument started in 1960. You know, certainly there was someone who was enslaved and realized that something had been taken from them, and that they should get it back. You know, so I had like this hunch. And then, you know, as soon as I started, you know, calling around and talking to historians, you know, it became clear that, you know, reparations, the argument for reparations is literally as old as the country itself. I was just doing some research. It's funny how things hit you. I was doing some research today, just having this discussion via Twitter, about the roots, you know, of all these Ivy League schools in enslavement, right? And no one knows about this. It's a great book by Craig Wilder, Ebony and Ivy, that explores all of this. And one of the things that people don't know is, you know, the seed money for Harvard Law School goes back to a gentleman by the name of Isaac Royal. Isaac Royal was a big, big slaveholder in the Caribbean and also in Massachusetts. And I didn't make this connection when I had read the story. But Isaac Royal is, you know, turns out to be a royalist. It's funny. I'm turns out to be a royalist. It's a little bit corny humor for you there. Corny historian humor. Royal was a royalist. Can't, I mean, come on, you got to laugh at that one. Sorry. That was really corny. I'm sorry. And so, you know, he flees after, you know, the revolution. And one of the people who he owns is Belinda Royal. And he leaves all of these, you know, resources aside. You know, and Belinda Royal, with the help of the free African-American population in Boston, in the 18th century, the late 18th century, makes the case. You know, listen, I was, you know, taken, you know, from Africa at a very, very young age. I was worked all my life. Much of what, you know, this man has accumulated here in Boston is a direct result of my labor. I should get something for that. And crazily enough, she actually does get something. The legislature, you know, passes a pension that they take basically out of the property that Mr. Roy owns, and she actually, you know, gets reparations. We have a whole tradition. The Quakers, for instance, very, very big. Early Quakers in the 18th century, very, very big. It, you know, immediately occurred to them that when you enslave, everybody knows, like, the Quakers took this stand against enslavement and said, listen, you know, at least in certain sections of the Quakers, if you're going to hold slaves, you can't be a Quaker anymore. What less people know is that in a lot of the meetings around the states, they also took a stand and said, and not only do you have to free, you know, all the people that you've enslaved, but you actually have to give them things. So there's a history of Quakers paying out reparations. There's a history of even our founding fathers paying out reparations. I want to get this right, but I'm pretty sure that when George Washington, you know, he leaves in his will that all of, you know, the folks that he's enslaved will be emancipated. He can't just cut them loose. I want to say this, and forgive me if I'm not getting the figure right, but I believe he gives them 10 acres and leaves, you know, money left aside for their education. So we have a whole history of this. There's a guy we quote, you know, who was president of Yale, who immediately says, he says, listen, to cut these people loose, you know, and just to, you know, leave them into the wild and not do anything for them, you know, is a travesty, you know, and it will be down upon us. You know, we will pay this. When God, you know, comes before us and, you know, has to make a judgment, you know, he'll remember that this is how, you know, we handled one of our greatest sins. So one of the things, and this is just theoretical, one of the things that you notice, though, is you can trace the history of white people actually making the argument for reparations until roughly about 1820 or 1830. And what happens around 1820 or 1830 is you get this cotton boom in the South. And enslaved black people, the value of enslaved black people just shoots through the roof. Such to the point that by the time you get to 1860, there are 4 million enslaved black people in the South. And taken together, they're worth some $4 billion, a number that exceeds basically all of the assets, all the productive capacity, all the railroads, all the nascent factories, basically, you know, all the banks, everything that we have in America put together is worth less than the enslaved black people in this country. And that's like a, you know, I'm not saying that as a definite in terms of like when you see this reparations argument trail off among white people, but it's, you know, subject for further study. And so what happens is after 1865, when black people are, you know, when you get emancipation, it becomes a primarily primarily black argument, though not totally. You know, you have, like, actually ex-Confederate officers with whole sorts of schemes for reparations, you know. But then you have just, it becomes a black political tradition of asking for it. So I think the importance of that is to understand that this is not, you know, something that, you know, some crazy, you know, woolly-eyed, you know, radicals came up with in 1968 and suddenly decided. Because, you know, what people will say is, well, you should, you know, ask for it in 1865. Well, people did ask for it in 1865. You know, the society was not structured such that, you know, to grant that request. We have people on the record, you know, asking for it. And the fact of the matter is the strategy of the state has always been to deny the request at the time, and then once those people die, to say, you know what, we should have paid it, but it's too late now. I mean, this is just a typical, you know, a strategy of running out the clock. But I think it's important to know that this is not, you know, an argument that begins in the 1960s. This is a very, very old argument in America.
Can you describe a bit about your own intellectual history with this idea? Anastasia mentioned your memoir earlier, The Beautiful Struggle, story of your growing up in West Baltimore. I'm wondering how you understood growing up the kind of relative position, economic position of whites and blacks in America, what the reasons were for it, and when it began to make sense to you that there was maybe some justice in a solution like this.
Right. So, I talked about this earlier, very early on in my life, and I think this is true for a lot of, you know, black people. You understand the community that you live in is very, very different than at least America as it projects itself, you know, out to the world on television. And you're clearly aware of that. I had the great, you know, luxury and the great asset of having, you know, fairly, you know, well-read parents, you know, who, you know, and I have a lot of books in my house. So you get some sense that, okay, you know, this is related to racism. You know, if you wanted to understand why you live a certain way and why other folks live a certain way, you know, you get the answer, you know, racism. Well, in the crudest speech, you know, in some of our houses, you get the white man. That's like the argument, you know. I can remember being a kid trying to picture, like, the white man. What does that look like? Like, is this like one white man, literally, like, you know, like sketching, okay, black people are going to live over here, white people. Like, what does that mean, you know? But in black communities, other people say, oh, the white man ain't going to let you have a white man. White man, wow. And there were no white people in my neighbors. I didn't know any white people. So I didn't know, like, that was a physical. I have, like, that as a very strong memory, like, wondering, is that an individual person? You know? But what you have to do, you know, you get that answer, and then, you know, as you get older, and, you know, if you're curious, that, you know, doesn't quite, like, totally add up. You know? And people tell you things, like, they say, well, you know, the entire country, you know, is built on your back. You know, it's built on taking things from you. They ripped you off, da-da-da-da-da. And that's, you know, rhetorical. And I'm not mocking that because, you know, what became clear later to me was that reflects some deep intuitive sense of the truth, even if you can't, you know, connect all the dots. You have some sense of what happened. So, you know, as I, you know, grew older and I, you know, went off, you know, to school and, you know, studied the problem even more, I actually moved away from reparations, you know, because there's this tendency in, you know, these institutions of higher education and, you know, just in exploration, is just to try to complicate everything, which I think is a good impulse, but sometimes it ain't that complicated, man. You know, sometimes it's just, you know, you took that from that person and that, you know, it's just math. It's just 1 + 1. But there's like this tendency, and we, you know, this is good. I don't think this is bad. Like, I don't think it's a bad phase. They said, well, you know, have you accounted for class? And have you thought about this? And then, you know, how does gender figure into this? And that's good. You should ask those questions. Please don't take that the wrong way. You should, but a lot of times you ask those questions, and I went through that phase over and over. Well, maybe it doesn't account for this. Maybe it was that. Maybe it's this. Maybe there's a system, you know, over here. And what do you think about poor whites in Appalachia? You go through all of those phases of trying to figure it out, right? And then you come back, and what you end up with, even if you say it in some, you know, more sophisticated ways, you end up with the white man. That's what you you come back. So, now you don't say it like that, right? That's not how you say it. Because that's not what it is. But, you know, that guy who, you know, when you were 8 years old was like, you know, you've been ripped off. You know, he built it all on your back. You said, damn, he was right. But it's good because you went through all those phases. You have the science, right? And you can, you know, cite studies and dates, and you get figures, and you can put, you know, all of this mathematics behind what was just intuitive before. And that, you know, just makes it, you know, really, really stronger. But I tell you, that was deeply, deeply chastening to me, you know, to come back to some truths. You know, I was raised around a very, very radical, you know, black nationalist tradition. And, you know, as I got older, there was a strong impulse to interrogate that and subject it to as much rigor as I could. And, you know, I would not have predicted this, say, 15 years ago, but the fact of the matter is what happened was you ended up coming back to that, that the science itself ultimately brought you back, not to all of the conclusions, not to all of them, but certainly to some of them, you know, certainly to reparations, you know, and I did that, you know, I would not, you know, say that I was, I can't tell you that, you know, I was always on board with that. I can't tell you that I, you know, in any, you know, it's very nice that, you know, the article has reached, you know, masses of people. But the thing that really, really humbles me is there were some people who did not need to read Making a Second Ghetto, who did not need to make 5 visits to North Lawndale, who did not, you know, need to, you know, go through all of this, you know, rigmarole, you know, that I needed, you know, to reach, you know, a basic essential truth about what had happened.
Do you have a clear picture now of what this white man actually looks like?
No, because I think, like, I mean, you got to think about that some sort of metaphorical sense. I mean, it's the way of using a person, you know, to implicate an entire system, I think, or to represent an entire system. But, yeah, it was a very interesting point. I think in my mind I picture Ronald Reagan. That's like I think of Ronald. But you know what? You know what I think that is, though? I think that's just because, actually, in fact, I think that's just because Reagan was was president through the period in which I was hearing those words. But you know what I mean? So like for the early period of my life when my family and my, you know, the friends of my parents would say things like that, Reagan was the president. And so it's like an immediate like association with that in my mind. It's not even policy based. I mean, you can make that association too, but I think a lot of it is just being a child during that period.
Can you categorize reactions to this piece? What kind of feedback have you gotten? There was immense reaction in the moment and subsequent weeks. You've been out talking about it some since then. Well, actually, a good deal and continue to write about it.
Right.
And so young, old, white, black, male, female, how would you describe what kind of patterns you've seen and how people react to this argument?
Well, so, I mean, for me, the most interesting and, I would argue the most gratifying has been, you know, African-Americans who are above the age of, say, 60 or so, because they have direct experience with this. And I shared some of this, you know, with you. You get, you know, letters from people's children or from the people themselves. And they say, that was me. That was me. That happened. And, you know, and that has not simply come from Chicago. That's been, you know, a national outpouring. That is gratifying in the sense that, you know, folks got their story told. And, you know, that pleases me a great deal. I think across the board for African Americans, again, there was this intuitive sense that somebody did something to us and they owe us. Now, I can't give you, you know, all the math on that. I can't, you know, outline how the system happened, but I'm going to tell you, I know this ain't a mistake, you know, and I know that I'm not crazy. And so for a lot of people, I think for a lot of African Americans, the feeling has been reassuring almost. I was not crazy. You know, so I think, like, that's been one thing. And I think, again, in the way that The Atlantic did it, like, you know, you can look at the article, but then you can actually, like, physically see the maps. I think it's just so, like, jarring. I mean, it's not even really hard. This doesn't, you know, again, this is 1+1. You know, redlined was here. That's where we lived. This is what the policy was. You know, and we have so many quotes. I mean, you know, just to have, like, I mean, you know.
The actual requirements for...
Right.
Who you couldn't give a mortgage.
Right. And they're right there. Yeah. And or quotes like from, say, like the trade organization. You know, at one point we got like the trade organization, you know, very explicitly saying, here's who you should not sell to in white neighborhoods. You shouldn't sell, you know, to, you know, a madam. You shouldn't sell to, you know, a drug dealer or whatever, ne'er-do-well, a thief. And you shouldn't sell to a black person, you know, of means who thinks that, you know.
With a college degree, who thinks.
Right. Who thinks that they have a right to improve yourself or something like that. Yeah. I mean, and so it's like clear. I mean, that's just 1+1, man. You know, and I think, like, all our talk about implicit racism and trying to, you know, read things into things and, you know, things not, you know, has blinded us to how much of that is so real. And so I think for folks to see that, it's like, you know, it says, well, yeah, I wasn't crazy. And then, you know, there's been a reaction from white people, which has been really, really interesting to me, who just, like, come up and say, I just didn't know. I mean, that's just the main, you know, I didn't know. How did this happen? I had no idea. I had no idea. Somebody will say, I had this conversation just, you know, a few weeks ago. Somebody says, you know, I grew up in this neighborhood, not here, so, but a particular neighborhood. I think the woman was from Milwaukee. is that, and I was friends with a little black girl, and her dad was a doctor. And I remember going to her house and wondering why her dad was a doctor and they lived in that neighborhood. And I didn't understand why they didn't live in a neighborhood like we lived in. And that just sort of, you know, going over and you just go on with your day, right? Just nods on you and you keep going. And then to, like, see it, you know, laid out, I think, you know, it was quite shocking, you know, for a lot of people, whether they bought the case for reparations or not, but to see the actual policy, you know, I think is just pretty undeniable.
Explain the white reaction a little bit more. Do you mean, thank you, I now understand how the world looks through your eyes, or thank you, I now understand why...
I think it's now I understand my country a little better. Yeah. It's mostly stunned. Like, it's a kind of stunned, oh, my God, this really happened thing.
But is it also that now I understand why this set of issues will not go away? Like,
maybe. I'm not sure. Yeah. Actually, I'm not sure. Maybe. Maybe. The thing that sticks with me is just the sheer... Like, folks are astounded. Like, they're just astounded. And I think a lot of that is because, you know, we think about... Because, you know, okay, so, I knew slavery was brutal. Okay, fine, I knew that. And, yes, I knew Jim Crow was brutal. Yes, I knew that. But I didn't know that rolled into that was the denial of where people could buy their homes. And, you know, a kind of intentional denial of people's ability to build wealth. And then having done that, setting them out in such a way so that people could take from the wealth that they had built. I just think, you know, a lot of people just didn't know. A lot of people just didn't know. I mean, again, like, I had the intuitive sense. I had some sense of redlining. But when you see people, you know, actually say things, it's just, it's tough. I mean, the case that, you know, with the contract buyers leave, when you see the foreman of the jury walk out, you know, after, you know, the case, you know, goes against the contract buyers league and say, you know, explicitly say to a newspaper, you know, we hope that this will help, you know, right all the nonsense that, you know, began with Brown versus the board. It's like, Jesus, what am I supposed to do with that? That don't require reading no tea leaves right there. You know, and to have it, you know, just be one, it's a little astounding. And so I think, you know, for a lot of folks, that was tough.
I'm going to open it up to you guys in just a minute. I have a couple more questions. I wonder what you think. You had occasion to sit down a couple of times with the president.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder what you, I mean, and this is terribly unfair. It's hypothetical on so many levels and so forth and so on. What do you think he makes of this argument?
Wow. I don't know. And I legitimately don't know. I haven't, you know, none of those occasions came, have come after that piece came out, that's for sure.
Yeah.
You know, I've been invited back after that. But I don't think that's why. I'm half joking. I don't think that's why. Listen, I think the president is, like, really, really intelligent. Like, this is just really, really intelligent. And I think, you know, it's tough to deny the math there. You know, I think it's, like, really, really hard to fix your mind to say, no, nothing is owed. I think that's extremely, extremely difficult. Now, you can, you know, maybe say, well, here's why I can't pay, although I think that's difficult, too. But I like to think, you know, he would at least acknowledge the debt. You know, having said that, you know, he's in a very difficult position, I think, because it's what you know as your private self, right? But you weren't elected to be your private self. You know, you were elected to represent the United States of America. I was watching, you know, the president after, it was one of these press conferences after Ferguson, and, you know, people like me, you know, we sit there and we parse, you know, every public statement that he makes and where he got it right and where we felt he got it wrong. But it's like after Ferguson, to ask, you know, Barack Obama, he's in his, I guess, what, sixth year at that point, you know, the president to analyze it. I mean, what do you want the president of the United States to say, man? Do you want me to say to you that, listen, the folks who live there are the result of policies that this country passed. And the reason why that boy was left laying on the concrete for 4 hours is a direct reflection about how this country feels about black people and how it's treated black people for the entirety of their residency here in the United States. Why are you surprised? Did the president say that? Can't say that. I mean, your president can't say that. I mean, he can't. And, you know, I felt like, and, you know, I don't want to mind read here, but, I mean, it must be fatiguing, you know, to have to, you know, prod the country forward. I don't, you know, at the same time, understanding certain things that you must understand privately, you know, and not really, really being able to go there. So, I, you know, watching, I just felt like it was just this sort of fatigue, like, okay, you know, Plus, what do you want me to say here, man? I mean, what do you really, you know, what do you actually want me to say about this? I don't know. Maybe one day I'll find out, you know?
I mean, he has made the argument that there's a very different strain in the discourse around race in America that you've written about a lot.
Right.
Let's go back to Booker T. Washington before that. Of self-reliance,
right,
and that this isn't about. Don't expect this to get given to you. Don't expect the debt to be paid.
Right.
Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You quote Mayor Michael Nutter in the piece saying, "Pull up your pants
and
buy a belt."
Literally buy a belt. Yeah.
Do you sense a change in the rhetoric now or the? First of all, what's wrong with that approach?
I think I get two ways of looking at, you know, that do-for-self approach. There are people who have no interest, frankly, you know, in the African-American struggle and in African-American people, period, you know, who are just looking to, you know, not have to take a hard look at history. And so they say things like that, and they say, what is the past? It doesn't matter. So that's one group. I think within the African-American community, and, you know, I'm kin to some of these people, there's a very, very different strain, which is, yes, we do recognize that. That's definitely true. Yes, something really is old. Yes, you did get ripped off. But it's a much more, I don't want to say cynical, let's say pragmatic way of looking at it. It says, what makes you think these people are going to do anything for you? Like, you know, in your right mind, what makes you think, you know, what piece of history, what piece of evidence are you able to furnish to say that some critical mass of white people in this country will realize that you are owed something and in good faith make an effort to pay it back? You know, if I may be so bold, I mean, Mr. Ross, yesterday we had this thing at North Lawndale, and Mr. Ross has his own critique of reparations, which I'm sure he would give. And one of the things he said yesterday, he said, listen, if you get reparations, you better make sure you have a different court system. You better make sure you have a different educational system. You better make sure you got a different media. You basically better make sure you got a different society. These are not people who are in denial about the fact of racism and are not, you know, in denial about, you know, the fact of an actual debt. The problem is, you know, so I thought, like, I have, like, a great degree of respect, you know, for that. I think that's what my dad was saying. My dad was saying that, but it's with my dad, because me and my father have had this debate for years now. The problem I have with that, though, is if you accept the humanity of black people, if you accept that black people, you know, will fall down, the black people, you know, because they're human, because there are 40 million of us, that, you know, to expect a group of 40 million people to be twice as good, you know, as an actual pragmatic strategy is to effectively expect them to be superhuman. We don't expect, you know, white people to be superhuman. And if you accept that black people are human, you have to accept that they probably can't be superhuman, that they can't be superhuman. That is the definition of being human. The mediocrity is part of the, you know, being human is not some, you know, beautiful, you know, experience, you know, written in pastels and flowers. You know, part of that is your mediocrity. I mean, that's part of being human, you know, your ordinariness. And if you, you know, bring that analysis to black people that, you know, sometimes we are just as lazy as the next person. You know, sometimes, you know, we fall down just like the next person, and there's nothing exceptional in our laziness. There's nothing exceptional in our falling downness. The strategy for twice as good ultimately can't work. You know, and it can't work because black people are because of the humanity. You know, I think that's great advice if you're talking to your child. I think that's great advice if you're talking to your children. I think it's great advice if you were talking to a group of young people, you know, about how they need to individually exceed, because I think, you know, you can have a conversation about how each of us at the end of the day is ultimately responsible for the flourishing of our own bodies, for the protection of our own bodies. We have to do all we can, you know, to protect our own bodies. And even, you know, if the odds seem, you know, completely against us, you know, you don't really have the luxury of quitting. I think that's one conversation that can be had. When you get to a policy level, and I would, you know, make this critique, not only when you get to a policy level. When you are the head of state, you are the titular representative of America and American heritage. And everything that, you know, America has thus ever done to black people, I think you forego the right to stand up and tell people, listen, ultimately, this is on you, pull your pants up. Because you're the representative of why they got to pull up their pants in the first place. You are a representative of the reason why, you know, these folks have to be twice as good in the first place. You know, the president, you know, says, I think if he would say, well, I'm speaking as an African-American, you know, who's, you know, been through this experience. That's the place I'm speaking from. I'm not, you know, necessarily speaking as, you know, head of state. But see, the problem with that is when asked for policy, specifically directed to black people, the answer is I am, you know, and the answer has been, I am president of the entire United States. Well, I agree with that. I agree with that. And thus, you must be critiqued as the president of the entire United States. And part of that is legacy. Part of that is heritage. Part of that is the practices. You know, when the president of the United States goes every Memorial Day, you know, and talks about, you know, the sacrifices, you know, of the American, you know, military, he's invoking the heritage of this country. When the president of the United States, you know, talks about Abraham Lincoln, when he goes to Springfield, as he did to inaugurate his campaign, you know, he's invoking heritage. This is heritage too, man. This is why heritage ain't just the thing that flatters you. And so I think, you know, like those of us, you know, who, you know, admire, you know, the president, who respect the president, who think, you know, the president is, you know, just, you know, carrying quite a bit, still have a responsibility to critique that. And so, like, as much as I, you know, admire that philosophy, you know, and as much as I very much grew up on that philosophy, I'm a product of that philosophy, as a policy, because black people are human, because black people are part of the country, I don't know how that works as a national policy, you know, of self-liberation. You know, we're part of this. We're part of this. You know, we were ripped off. That, you know, is the immediate reason for why, you know, we're in this condition. And as hard as the answer, you know, might be to, you know, affect, and, you know, given the fact that the answer might not and probably won't be affected in our lifetime, in our kids' lifetime, maybe not even in our grandkids' lifetime, that does not, you know, forego us, you know, give us the right to look away. I mean, one of the things, I'm sorry, I get going on this a little bit. Like, one of the things, and I'll cut it off after this. I'm sorry for this long, lengthy answer. But one of the things I think about is if we look at the black community today, right, and again, you know, it's starting from the premise of humanism, and you say, well, part of the problem is we have not taken, you know, we have not done all that we can do. And we haven't, you know, been, you know, twice, we, you know, we've fallen down on the job. We've done X, Y, and Z. Well, if you accept that we, you know, we are as human as other previous generations, then, well, man, you got to look back to the 1960s and the Civil Rights Movement when they were executing black people in Mississippi, in Alabama. Did that generation not do as much as it was supposed to do? Is that a critique that we would make of them? When we look at the era of political leadership in black people during the Red Summers, during the era of lynching at the turn of the century, and say, you know what, those people were too lazy. They could have done more. When we look at enslaved black people in the 1830s and the 1840s and say, why didn't you fight harder? You know, why didn't you rebel? Why didn't you go, if you had rebelled, we wouldn't have ended up in there. Had you been superhuman, had you been twice as good, you could have overthrown slavery on your own through your sheer will. We would never do that. That'd be totally, totally disrespectful. And so my argument is that, you know, we should show the same respect that we show for ancestors, for the community that came before us, for our young people. That they deserve that exact, you know, the same respect. And so I just think, I think that idea has to be interrogated and has to be critiqued, even being sympathetic to where it comes from.
All right, let's open it up to questions from the audience. I'd actually like to reinforce Steve's admonition at the outset that please ask your question in the form of a question and a short question to preserve as much time as we can for others to ask questions.
Hi, thank you. This question is coming from the DC U Chicago Alumni Club Watch Party. In the months since writing your piece, is there anything you would change or update? Have you seen any progress in reparations as a result of your piece? Thank you.
I mean, I haven't seen any progress. But that also, like, I also wouldn't, I, like, it's not my, don't say, it's outside of the realm of a writer to do that. You know, like, I, you know, my job is then to move on to next and to not, you know, like, sit here too long. I can't. You know, I wrote the piece. I hope there are people who have been fighting for reparations for a very, very long time. I hope the piece gives them some ammo. You know, there are activists who have been dealing with this for a very, very long time. I hope it gives them some ammo, you know, to go out and, you know, do what needs to be done. But as a writer, I sort of have to keep going, you know, and you know, other lines, you know, down the question. There's not much about the piece I would change. The hope is that, you know, in you know, the reporting that I do going forward, it enhances, you know, it asks other questions that are related, you know, to that piece.
Next question.
Hi,
question.
Hi. I have a question from Chloe, who's watching from our overflow room. You talk about reparations being the full acceptance of our collective biography and its consequences. What steps do you imagine our country taking to achieve this? What can we do to move in this direction?
Well, I think the first big thing is I outline in the piece, and people, they hate the small, most basic answers. You can urge whatever congressional district you live in. John Conyers introduces H.R. 40, which is a bill to study reparations and, to study the effects of enslavement and its subsequent legacy on African Americans and assess this question of whether black people deserve reparations. You can urge your congressman to support H.R. 40. And this is, not a small thing. This is not a small thing at all. An accounting has to be made. A study has to be made. This is exactly the way that the struggle for Japanese American reparations went for internment. There was a study. There was an assessment made of the damage. And then, Ronald Reagan, the white man, symbolic white man, signed a bill. It gave, reparations to Japanese Americans who were interned. I think the exact same political process needs to happen to other, for other people. There are people, also, who are in the activist community, for example, with the group in Cobra, who have been pushing a more internationalist, approach. And that really is, their vein. I think you can look up at some of the activists, for example, in Cobra, who have been pursuing this for years and look at what strategies they're pursuing. You can support that. So I think there are a range of things. The basic recommendation I get, is to immediately get behind H.R. 40. But I wouldn't be contained to that. I wouldn't be restrained with that.
Thank you. I'd like to know, ideally, what reparations would look like to you if you had complete control over it, whether it's cash or policy, education reform, and then what the impact of that would be 10, 20, 50 years down the road.
Well, if I had complete control of it, it wouldn't really be reparations. That's part of the problem. I mean, I think people imagine reparations happening in the current political system as it is today. So, one of the discussions we give, we'll say, there was a check cut right now to, black people for, $50,000 a piece, whatever you're going to say. What would that effect, be right now? But see, you have to envision. You have to understand how America thinks about racism and black people right now, right? And the predominant idea is pretty much that was in the past, that was a long time ago, right? A world in which H.R. 40 gets to the House floor, a world in which, there's a partnership for H.R. 40, in the Senate, and a world where, a president actually gets behind that and you have actual hearings, that is a very, very different America. It's a completely, completely different America. It's an America with a totally different perspective on its history. It's a very, America with a very, totally different, perspective on black people. And in that world, what would reparations be? I see it as folks may differ with me on this, but I see it as an essentially democratic process. Because if that doesn't happen and you just cut a check, we've learned nothing. I mean, absolutely, we've learned nothing at all. Nothing will actually, necessarily change. But in a world where reparations does happen, I think, what you have is a broad commitment to fix what happened in the past. So that may, take the form of, deliberately, giving somebody a check. I think about Mr. Clyros, and I think, give Mr. Clyros a check right now, right? Like, you could just do that. That's something that should be done. Just to make this, knowable, to put this in, a knowable frame. Look, we have the maps for, where redlining took place. We have census reports. We know who lived where. We could set up a process right now, for folks who were, sent into, situations with loans, that were predatory because of redlining. We can, set up a situation right now for folks who can say, listen, I tried to access certain things through the GI Bill and I was denied. Now that's not a radical option, but that's like a narrow cast thing that's doable right now, in terms of, folks that, have been ripped off that we know about. I'm not arguing that it should be limited to that. But, we do have those starting points. But I think, a time when you get to that level, that's just, it's a totally, totally different America. And it's not just a matter of sending out checks. If you study, like the reparations that Germany gave, in the piece we talk about them giving reparations to Israel, but that wasn't the end of it. That was the start of it. The process continues even up till today. Now, we're talking about I mean, going back to 1619. You know, how long would that take? How long will it take to make that right? But, you know, a country that gets into, you know, the mode of reparations, I think, is you know, would be committed to that law of process. This is a different America. It's a very, very different America where that happens.
Hi. So I have two questions that are actually associated. One is, are you thinking about writing a book? And two is, what's the next step in, you know, after you experience the shocked white person who's like, I had no idea? So then there has to be a next step that involves education of somehow, and how do you imagine that continuing?
Yeah, I'm working on edits for a book right now. I'm sorry, so I should, God willing, the manuscript will be done by the end of the year. It's kind of rooted in some of the stuff around, but it's not like the case for reparations blown out in the book. It's something a little different. I don't know what happens after that. You know, I don't know where a shocked white person goes after, you know, realizing that this was something that happened. I mean, that really is for shocked white person to decide, you know? I mean, are you going to, you know, just be shocked? And, you know, and I'm not, you know, like, there's a kind of shock, well, I didn't know that happened. And then you just continue on with your day, right? But you like to think that people will keep reading. You know, you like to think that people will, you know, to pursue, you know, their education and will not, you know, stop with the Atlantic, and we'll go on. As a writer, that's beyond my control. I try to play my position. I do my part. You know, and I hope that folks continue, you know, self-educate. You know, I always, you know, try to be very clear about the resources I use to educate myself, you know, and I hope that people follow up.
Hi. So there's an advocacy group in Chicago called the Anti-Eviction Campaign that works to repossess... The Anti-Eviction Campaign that works to repossess abandoned houses by occupying them. What do you think about this, and do you think this could be incorporated into reparations in any way?
Well, this is the first time I'm hearing about it, so I'm not really qualified to give an informed opinion, regrettably. Yeah, I try to keep my feet underneath me, man, when I throw a punch. So, I don't want to, you know, get out there. That doesn't mean that, you know, what they're doing is, you know, unjust or just or anything like that. It's just that I just don't know. I just don't know.
Hey, so I currently read essays for college seniors at Martin Luther King High School, and it's 92% black, but it's a very high-achieving high school, and so all the seniors are going to colleges with...
And it's a very high achievement. Yeah. Not but.
And a lot of the students are going to very prestigious universities with low black populations. And what do you have a word for the class of 2014 as to how to take black culture, pop culture, to the university campus?
Yeah, I have great advice for them, and the advice is apply to Howard University. That's my advice, and I'm not being flip here. Here's what I'll say. My advice is to apply to Howard University and then go to those elite schools for grad school. That's my advice, and here's why I say that. It's impossible for me to imagine writing the case for reparations without having gone to a historically black school, and Howard in particular. But I would spread that out to HBCUs in general. The thing that HBCUs offer, and this happens because I'll come to talk to at a school like this. I'll be up at Cornell where I was, a few months ago, and a young lady said to me, she said, how am I supposed to deal with, you know, the fact that, you know, people say I'm only here because of affirmative action? You know, and I answered the question, but, you know, the other thing I said is, listen, like, that has never, by the time that was my experience, I had gotten to the Atlantic. I was thoroughly formed. I never had that as a question in my head at all, you know, that, you know, I had gotten here because out of some, you know, sort of thing that somebody had done. Not that you should feel that way to begin with, but what I'm saying is I was never, that's a tough thing to face at 18. That's a hard thing for somebody to put on you at 18 when you're still trying to find yourself. Historically, black schools give African-American students the chance to sit back and assess themselves and confront their tradition in a semi-private space. It's not totally private space, but in a semi-private space. And that just allows for a range of debate and dialogue that, you know, is just beyond, you know, anything that you know, I experienced after I left. You know, it's one thing to have to confront your history, you know, say here, you know, in mixed company, which is great. But sometimes we get defensive. You know, we feel the need to defend ourselves against other people. Or a professor, you know, who may not, you know, be black says something. And you feel this need to defend yourself. And at Howard, that was like totally off the table. You know, it freed people up to say, you know, the things that, you know, you really, really need to say. You know, to talk. Seriously, yeah, one of the things I think about, and I'll just tell this story really quickly. You know, those of us who you know, came to Howard, you know, were heavily influenced by Malcolm X, heavily influenced by black nationalism, you know, I felt this, you know, real, real need to, you know, make ourselves human, and the way to make ourselves human was to prove that we had, you know, built things as advanced and as beautiful and as great as anything that white people had built. And that sent us on a chase for heroes. And one of the, you know, people that I think about was that there's this woman who's, a brilliant military strategist, Queen Nzinga, what is, you know, now the Congo today. And there's a, you know, famous story that I remember reading about. And she's going in to negotiate with the Dutch who are trying to, you know, take from her. And they want to disrespect her. So what they do is they don't give her a chair, right? And she immediately orders one of her servants to, you know, sit down and basically get on all fours. And she uses this woman as a stool. And this story is told, and it's true, to show, you know, like the craftiness of Nzinga about how she wouldn't be disrespected. And I read about that, you know, and it, you know, made me, like, you know, feel really proud and everything. You go out there and say, yeah, you know, we got brilliant people too. And you go someplace like Howard, right, and that's cool, you know, but, like, the need to assess, to assert your self-esteem is not the same. You don't really need it because everybody around you is black. It's clear. You know, brilliance of black people is right there. There's no, you know, real argument about that. And then, man, we got to breaking that story down. And we got to thinking about, like, what enslavement actually was and how it was actually the loss of your body and how, like, if you, you know, really, you know, get on a human level and you want to understand your condition as the descendant of slaves, you have much more in common with the woman who was used as a chair than you do with Queen Nzinga. And that was like a profound moment for me. You know, it was like a deep, you know, sort of realization that I could not have made, you know, within, you know, frankly, a white space. The opportunity to interrogate that and to interrogate yourself and to subject yourself to the harshest possible rigor, you know, and then at the end of it, you know, come out feeling like you're all right. You know, I saw Bellow had written this thing at the time. It just greatly, greatly disturbed me. He wrote, you know, assessing, you know, black diaspora. He said, who is the Tolstoy of the Zulus? And I went on this time, I got to find the Tolstoy of the Zulus. Who is the Tolstoy? There must be a Tolstoy of the Zulus, right? And, you know, just doing, you know, this reading at Howard, I came across this brilliant Ralph Wiley essay. And Ralph Wiley replies and says, I mean, just this is like the most liberating thing I've ever read. He says, Tolstoy is the Tolstoy of the Zulus. And I thought, damn. Wow. Oh, like the whole, you know, gambit was wrong. Like you can't even accept the premise. That, you know, sort of realization, and that sort of interrogates for me, you know, for what I need was only possible, you know, in a black space. So I think, regrettably, you know, this is no disrespect to, you know, elite institutions. I think, though, for black people, it's essential at that young age to have that room to interrogate yourself, you know, to look at yourself. And then after that, you can go out and see the world. You know, the world's going to be majority white anyway. You got plenty of time. You got plenty of time to go to Yale, Harvard, Princeton. You got plenty of time for that. You know, but at that crucial point, I'm a big believer in HBCUs. I'm going through this with my son right now. Yeah.
You touched on this in your piece and in your talk right now, that essentially when people hear reparations, the immediate snap judgment is a check being mailed out to black people, essentially. Mm-hmm. And when you actually read your piece, it's clear that what you're asking for, when you make your case for reparations, for you, reparations is a reckoning. It's much broader than that check. And yet, your
piece...
A
check is part of it.
A check is part of it. Right. But yet your piece is named The Case for Reparations, that very starkly. Was there ever any hesitation or ambivalence before the piece was published about putting that title on the front of it, and that it might turn away people who would otherwise be more willing to even engage the argument?
I don't think so. No, right?
We
no.
experimented with a couple of other possible headlines. I'm having trouble remembering what they were. But basically from the beginning, this was what we called the piece. And that was the only reason we hesitated at the last minute, because we just thought this had been our headline,
right,
the way we thought about the story through the editing process, and would it translate to the outside world? And we realized it would,
yeah.
So we went with it.
Yeah, no, it was very little. I think I told James this before. I always joke that people always, you know, come up to me. I was telling James, and they say, "How'd you get that in the Atlantic?" Like black people, they always come up to me, and I always joke that I want to say, well, you know, I had to tell them white folks we had to do X, Y, and Z, and they wasn't hearing me, and then we did this and that. But that's so not what happened. It's just that, you know, that's just that's
the,
not
the
what
truth
happened.
Is I was on vacation.
No, I mean, the real truth is, you know, I sent the pitch to, you know, Scott Stossel. And he read the pitch and said, okay. And I'm assuming he took it to you. And folks were like, okay, so how are we going to do this? There was no internal, you know, no resistance to, you know, the presentation, to how we were going to do it, to the investment, to the resources. And I think, you know, as happy as I am about that, you know, and the Atlantic, you know, being willing to go there, I actually think it's illustrative. And I was talking to James about this earlier. You know, one of the problems why we don't see more arguments like this is, you know, by the time I had, you know, pitched that, I had been, you know, effectively writing for The Atlantic for about 4 or 5 years. So, you know, we had a relationship. Very few African-American writers have those kind of relationships with, you know, magazines at The Atlantic's level. That's just the truth of it. And I think that's a, you know, more than people not being open, you know, to the ideas, it's just the relationship ain't there, man. You know, and there, you know, there are reasons why the relationships aren't there. You know, it's a very, if you think about, you know, how one breaks into the field of magazines, it's a very, very difficult, you know, process. It's very, very difficult for people who, you know, might be, you know, in the first generation of folks that are going to college, for instance. You know, tell somebody you want to work for a magazine. There was a, you know, happily, you know, The Atlantic, you know, internship is paid. You know, but that, you know, often is not the case for magazines. It certainly was not the case when I was coming up. You know, so you're trying to break in by, you know, either taking a, you know, a really, really low-paying job or, you know, no money at all, you know, and trying to live in a city like New York or D.C., difficult. Very, 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 very difficult. And so I think, you know, it's like good and bad news. I mean, the good news is, you know, folks really, you know, at least at the, I'll speak for The Atlantic. I'll speak for The Atlantic. The Atlantic, you know, as always, I've never had feeling like, you know, hey, I'm saying something crazy here and you guys aren't going to be able to. I've never had that. At the same time, you do look around the landscape and see that there's so few people to actually get, you know, to that point to have that relationship. And that's the problematic aspect of it.
One of the things that you brought up was the bootstrap mentality that seems to pervade everything. I'm one of those cynical old black men that you brought up in your talk. Mm-hmm. There was a study that Gallup did in the 50s that showed that 80% of white folks felt that black people had it just as good as white folks. Mm-hmm. And we hear the same thing now. So when we talk about this political landscape that we need to change in order for reparations to even be a realistic conversation, how do we get white folks to the point to actually understand that we as black people really do know what we're talking about when we tell them something is wrong?
Yeah. That's a great question. I love cynical old black people because what they do is, man, they bring the real. I mean, that's an actual question that has to be confronted. And you know, I'm of, as you might observe, I have some conflict in my head about it myself. So I think the first thing is, if you're going to work within the political process, if you're going to make a decision, you know, that you're not going to go out and get guns and try to, you know, overthrow something. If you're going to work within the political process, there has to be, you know, a political solution. And I don't know how you get around the fact that it's massive, massive debt. It's huge. I mean, you can see it represented in the wealth gap, but I suspect that doesn't even capture everything. I think we're at the point where for every, you know, nickel of wealth an African-American family has, a white family has a dollar. And that's the rough approximation of the wealth gap. That doesn't even completely cover it. As you know, we talk about in the piece, there's a level of neighborhood poverty that black people experience. So if you are an African-American family that, you know, makes around $100,000 a year, you tend to live in a neighborhood where people make about $30,000 a year. So you, you know, may, you know, on the income level, look like, you know, a relatively, you know, rich black family, but you live in housing that is, you know, comparable to a lower middle-class white family. These are tremendous, like hurdles that have to, you know, be dealt with. And as much as I would like to believe in, you know, the bootstrapping, I don't think it gets us there. You know, here's an even more distressing thought. I strongly suspect that much of what happens in history is outside of, you know, the direct control of human beings. And what I mean by that, the direct intention of human beings. Okay, so if you were an enslaved black person in 1820, you could look all the way back through your lineage, all the way back to 1619, and see nothing but enslaved black people. Beyond that, if you had economic knowledge of what was going on, you could see the rising value of black people. You could look forward and see that your kids were going to be enslaved too. There was every reason to believe that for the rest of your life and for the rest of your children's life and for the rest of your grandchildren and great-grandchildren's lives, you would be enslaved. I mean, you take it from that perspective. That would have been the pragmatic thing to think at that point. And yet people stood up and said this was wrong. And so you get to a point where you're talking about like 1855, 1858, around that period. And you get somebody like, you know, say Frederick Douglass, just to pick one person. And he's saying the just policy, the thing this country must immediately do, is it must liberate 4 million black people who are living in the South. You know, no questions asked. You ain't shipping them off to Africa. You know, let them right there. It's their land. They worked it. They deserve it just as much as anybody else. And people think Frederick Douglass is out of his mind. How is that going to happen? Have you looked at the worth of what black people, you know, represent to this country? The largest concentration of multimillionaires in this country are living in the Mississippi River Valley. Not in New York. Not in Chicago. Not in Boston. Mississippi River Valley, man. The, you know, largest export of this country in 1860, the time of the Civil War, is cotton. 60% of our exports is cotton. Slavery is that intrinsic. Who would have counted on white slaveholders overplaying their hand? That's what they did. I mean, that's what they did. They just took it too far. They just, you know, kind of lost their mind. And ended up proving Frederick Douglass right. So that 7 years later, you know, 7 years before, people were saying, you know, Frederick, you crazy. And 7 years later, he looks like a prophet. Because of the events of history, 1860, Douglass is telling people, listen, the immediate and just thing is to, you know, give black people guns and let them fight for their freedom. And what people are telling, Douglass, you are crazy. You know, white people who are in charge of things, you know, Abraham Lincoln on are saying, man, we don't know what these black people are going to do with these guns. They might shoot themselves. They might shoot us. We have no idea what's going to happen. Emancipation Proclamation comes out, and people ignore it. They focus on, you know, like the idea of freeing people. But the real deal is that the Emancipation Proclamation is a military order, and it immediately orders guns to be given to black people so that they can fight on their own behalf. And so by the time you get to Petersburg, you know, in 1865, you're talking about, you know, something like 1 in 10, you know, soldiers at Petersburg, a number might even be higher, you know, are African American. They're fighting for something that no one would have predicted at the onset of the war. What happened? Well, they thought they were going to be able to wrap the war up quick. Who would have counted on General McClellan being so bad? Who would have counted on that? You know, who would have counted on, you know, the Southern generalship being so good and these folks fighting, you know, for dear life to the end? So events that were outside of our control. This goes down to the Civil Rights Movement. I mean, one of the things that, you know, we appreciate the bravery of Dr. Martin Luther King. We appreciate the bravery of the Freedom Riders and all of those folks. But what people don't talk about is America had a problem at that point. And the problem was people were using Jim Crow as a weapon in the Cold War. And we had just had, you know, this fight, you know, in World War II with Nazism to see, you know, the logical ends of what racism was, the extermination, you know, of an entire group of people. America had a serious, serious problem. You know, how could it preach about, you know, liberty, you know, in Russia, you know, and still have, you know, what was going on down in the South? Now, listen, the activists took great advantage of that. You know what I mean? They did. But the situation itself was outside of their control. I say that to say, I think the job, you know, of folks in our situation is to say the right thing and to wait for our opportunity. The opportunity is out of control. Who knows what's going to happen? Who knows what's going to happen? You know, but it just like, you know, I folks in 1820, when it looked crazy to say, you know, the real just thing is to emancipate all of us, did not stop trying to say the right thing. I don't think that's a reason to not say the right thing right now.
Question. That's, you have the microphone, sir.
I'm not letting it go. Keep this going for as long as I want. No. Okay. So this question's gonna change, I guess. Just that it's different from the other questions in that I want to pose a little challenge. I appreciate the article. And I think it's great, and obviously. But one thing that I had trouble with is just the place that Native Americans don't occupy in it. And I know that you say academics, I'm not necessarily an academic, but you say there's a tendency to overcomplicate things, and I think I don't want to do that, but I think it's an important thing to think about when we're talking about land, right? When we're talking about black people taking up land in this country, and we trace the story back to 1619, what if we went back to 1492 and thought about that in terms of reparations? I mean, what should that do to the argument as far as making a case for this for black people when, you know, Native Americans have not just undergone genocide historically, but one of the primary ways that they were argued they had disappeared, disappearance theory is a subset of Native American studies, one of the primary arguments was that they had diluted their blood by intermixing with black people specifically. So when you look at these kinds of things, and you wrote these into the history of not just Native American people, but black people, there's a confluence, there's a convergence of stories that I think necessitates that we not just reside in the black-white binary as far as how we look at reparations, but look at how we understand this on a larger, more long-term scale. Sorry, I don't mean to go long. My question is simply, how do you rope that longer history into this case?
Right. So, you know, this is the case for reparations. I hope it's not the last article on reparations. You know, it shouldn't be the last word. I think in progressive circles, you know, there's, you know, always this search, and it's a good search, you know, for coalitions to see how, you know, we relate to other people, how things are interconnected. And you just, explain the history of how we could see that. Having said that, you know, I believe that the black experience is a particular thing. And I believe that the black people have a right. Let me change that. It's not even so much black people have a right. I think the history of itself is worthy of examination in and of itself by itself. And I don't think that I don't think that means that there's not a case for reparations for Native Americans. But I have the right, I keep saying right, I have the right to study black people. I have a right to think about that in and of itself. You know, just like, you know, one could make the same critique of an argument, you know, for example, reparations that were given to Israel after the Holocaust. Well, Jews weren't the only people that were killed in the Holocaust, you know? But folks have a right to talk about that. And then there should be, you know, another article, you know, about the Roma killed in the Holocaust. And there should be another article about, you know, homosexuals who were killed in the Holocaust. Just like there should be another article about reparations for Native Americans. This should, you know, I think one of the things that we mistake is because sometimes there's not a lot of bandwidth for a certain story, we try to put everything on one story. You know what I mean? This is one story, man. You know, this is just one story. And I did my best to research the hell out of it. Most of it is not actually rooted, you know, in that period. For the most part, you know, it's talking about housing. You know, and I think, like, you know, we have the right to reside in that space, to talk about our experience as an independent, separate field worthy of study. And somebody else should write, frankly, somebody else better informed, somebody else who's, you know, thought about this question all of their life should write the case for Native American reparations. I can't wait to read it, you know? And I'm not being flip, you know, I'm not being cynical, you know, I literally mean that, you know, because the flip side of that is if I say African American history and reparations as a concept specifically relating to black people is worthy of that, you know, sort of, you know, in-depth study, you know, Native American history is worth the same thing, and it should be given the same thing. You know, it shouldn't be an adjunct to my thing. You know, it shouldn't be, like, attached on just to make sure, you know, that I'm, you know, intersectional enough. You know, that ain't really the way to do it. You know, I think, like, you know, there's some value in focusing, you know, and going as deep as you possibly can, you know, in a specific area. And my hope is that folks who have thought, you know, about Native American history will look at that piece and will derive something from it. Just like, you know, when I, you know, went to do my research, you know, on reparations, you know, given to Israel, I was able to see certain things about reparations in terms of black people. Just when I did, you know, the research that was, you know, behind it in terms of reparations given to Japanese, I was able to see certain things and borrow it from that. You know, so my hope is that, you know, this will not be the end of the argument. It shouldn't be. This should not be the end. You know, folks should look at that, and then they should go and do that same amount of research. That's it.
All right. Thank you. Thanks, Ta-Nehisi, very much.
Thank you.
Please join me in a warm round of applause for Ta-Nehisi Coates, for James Bennett,